I'm Todd Zwillich. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us today. We begin with a look at the State of the Union in America, not the one President Trump gave on Tuesday, but the ones everyday workers participate in and how they've changed in recent years.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in our union, the union.
Billy Bragg says there's power in the unions, but how much remains in America? That's our first question on The Takeaway today. In 1983, over 20% of American workers belonged to a union. 35 years later, that number has been cut in half, about 10% today. But there are some small signs of life for unions. In just the past 2 weeks, employees at media companies Slate, Vox, and the Los Angeles Times have all voted to unionize. We'll have more on the situation at the LA Times later in the show. We're also going to check in with a small town paper where journalists are facing layoffs. There is a union push in journalism right now. In academia, too. Our own workplace here at WNYC in New York is a union shop. Many workers, including me, have been members of the SAG-AFTRA labor union for years. In total, white-collar fields like entertainment, law, and journalism have seen modest increases in union membership, up about 4% since 2010. But contrast that to manufacturing, where the percentage of union workers has fallen by about 3% since 2010, and, as we said, dramatically since its heyday in the 1980s. One high-profile bid came at a Nissan plant in Mississippi over the summer that we covered at the time with actor and activist Danny Glover.
This affects not only Nissan workers. This may be the epic center for the new civil rights issue within the 21st century workers.
Nissan workers in that case did not vote to unionize, and neither did 7,500 Boeing employees in South Carolina last February.
South Carolina, among other particularly southern states, they've made their pitch to companies as a low-cost, low-wage, non-union state, and so they view it as a hit to that competitiveness if they start becoming known as a place where workers will actually vote to unionize.
UNC Chapel Hill law professor Jeff Hirsch on this show last year. So what's behind the success of white-collar union efforts, even while lower-wage industries struggle to gain acceptance even among the workers they want to represent? What does it say about the state of a divided American economy? Ruth Milkman is a labor sociologist at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She joins me in the studio now. Ruth, welcome.
Hi.
Well, what's going on in industries like journalism that they've seen this surge in unionizing while unions in many other industries are falling by the wayside?
Well, so the falling by the wayside part is very easy to address because that's a very long-term trend that's been going on since at least 1981, when President Reagan fired the air traffic controllers. You may remember that.
I must tell those who failed to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law. And if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated. End of statement.
So in the private sector particularly, employers have been extremely hostile to unionism for many decades now. And the South is notorious for that, but it's actually true all over the country in private sector industries. The recent development that you're interested in, of this surge of interest in unionism among young journalists, is very interesting, although I must caution you to say that the numbers are quite modest so far. We're talking about maybe a couple thousand people altogether, which in the U.S. labor market of 140 million workers is a drop in the bucket. So even if all journalists in the millennial generation were to become union members, it wouldn't really affect the overall picture all that much. So that's just the kind of caveat. But to answer your question, I think what's driving it is that young, highly educated, college-educated workers, especially since the Great Recession of 2008, are facing a situation where the expectations that they had of the workplace are not being met in a very extreme way. So as this workforce, which kind of to get a job in journalism, as I'm sure you know very well, is quite challenging, quite competitive. These are the cream of the cream, the cream of the crop. They are very skilled young journalists, and now they face a labor market where work is extremely insecure, not very well paid, tremendous turmoil. You never know from 1 week to the next if you're going to be employed, not treated very well by the employers in many cases. And so the natural thing is to look for some kind of response to that. And in this case, it's taking the form of traditional labor unionism. It's not actually that unusual for college-educated workers to unionize. In the public sector, they're more unionized than other workers. Think of teachers, nurses, social workers. All those groups have been unionized for a long time. In the private sector, it's a little different. And the opposition is there among the employers in this sector, just like it is in North Carolina and South Carolina and Nissan, right? It's everywhere. But maybe these workers are a little less intimidated by the threats that employers make than less educated workers who also have many fewer options in the workforce.
Is there a risk of stratification here, though, further stratification in the economy, where, yeah, I understand journalism is a very small sector of the overall economy, but you see movements to unionize in sectors of journalism, in academia as well, where huge sectors of workers in the rest of the economy are basically seeing unions go away. What does that say about the economy more broadly?
Well, if this developed into a really large-scale trend, that might become an issue. Right now, we're talking about a couple thousand people. It really doesn't do much to affect that larger trend. The divide is there. It's not caused by anything to do with unionism. It's been there for a long time, and it's growing, and college-educated workers are doing way better than other workers, and that gap is intensifying partly because of the decline of unions in traditional blue-collar jobs. So again, if this were to really take off as a sort of major trend, then you'd have an issue. Right now, I think it's just a glimmer of possibility. We're seeing, you know, some very interesting developments in this group, but I don't think it has any impact on the larger economic divide.
Well, are there other industries that could take the cue from journalism and academia? Could this spread, or is this going to be limited to kind of an idiosyncratic little corner of the economy?
I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. I certainly don't. What I will say is that historically, when unionism has taken off, it has spread across sectors very rapidly. When workers see that it's possible to organize collectively and, you know, that success is out there among some other group. I mean, if you look back to the 1930s, which is the biggest upsurge of unionism ever, it started in manufacturing but quickly spread to department stores, restaurants, everywhere. So I suppose there's a possibility that this could be the beginning of something big, but I don't see any evidence for that just yet.
Well, let's talk about manufacturing for just a minute. This is not a new trend. It goes back, you said, to the start, to the 80s, when unionism really started to wane in this country. But when you look at the recent votes across the South, these were auto workers themselves voting not to unionize,
right?
Not necessarily a question of management crushing the union the way it, you know, would happen in the 30s. These were workers saying no. We don't want it.
Well, you got to put it in a bigger context. So it's true that in the 30s, management would hire thugs and Pinkertons to beat people up, sometimes even murder them when they tried to unionize. We don't see that today. But we do see management everywhere hiring what they call labor consultants, what people in the labor movement call union busters, who use all sorts of legal and sometimes illegal tactics to fight unionism and to intimidate workers who are presented with the prospect of voting yes or no on a union. And that definitely happened in these cases. And actually, there's also often opposition from politicians, elected officials in communities where unionism is attempted, who are fearful that if the union does succeed, that somehow this will make it more difficult for them to attract new investment and so on. So there's tremendous intimidation going on. It's not physical. It's intellectual and threats to close plants, firing activists. All these things happen routinely in the private sector, not just in manufacturing, but including there. And again, the South is sort of particularly notorious for this, but it's by no means limited to the South or to manufacturing, I might add.
Ruth, we're in an economy now where independent contracting, the sharing economy, Lyft driving, Uber driving, all of these things are getting more and more popular. Unions are on the wane. Yes, there are one or two little industries where unions are becoming more popular. But the message behind what you're saying here today, and when you look out across the economy, is that increasingly for the American worker, you're on your own.
That's absolutely right. And independent contractors, by the way, which, as you said, is a growing phenomenon, a lot of employers are converting what had been regular wage and hour salaried employment into independent contracting. And the reason for that is that those workers are actually not considered employees legally, and they're not eligible for unionization under our labor law. So that's part of what this is about. Plus, they're not protected by things like minimum wage laws. So there are all kinds of reasons why that trend is growing that are not unrelated to what we've been talking about.
So lots and lots of unions, Ruth, are struggling for relevance, struggling to sign up new workers, struggling to win union elections. They've tried to find other strategies to affect the labor market. $15 minimum wage is one example, right? How successful overall have those efforts been, even if, let's say, McDonald's and Burger King workers across America are not in a union?
Those efforts have been extremely successful, not by the metric of acquiring new union members, because I don't think there's been a single one acquired through this campaign, the Fight for 15. However, that fight, which is bankrolled by one of the largest unions in the United States, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, that has led to campaigns all over the country, particularly in blue states and cities, to raise the minimum wage. And many jurisdictions have done so. They've raised it to $15 an hour over, you know, phasing it in over a period of time. And that's probably done more for low-wage workers than almost anything you can think of in recent years. So I think that's probably been the single most effective campaign. It may eventually lead to some growth in unionization, but there's no sign of that thus far. Yet it's been extremely important. And maybe I can just add one other comment on that, which is that people think of unions as only caring about their members, which is right now a very small part of the labor force, about 1 in 10 workers who are union members. Historically, that's not been true. Unions have fought for things like increases in the minimum wage over many decades, and this is just the latest iteration of that.
Ruth Milkman, City University of New York, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have an experience unionizing at your company?
My name is Alice from Andover. The last time a group of employees band together to challenge unfair wages at my company, they were told that they could protest all they wanted, but their job security would not be guaranteed.
This is James Mitchell, Lydell, Texas. I am a self-employed house painter. I don't think anything's wrong with unions. The take on it here in Texas is, if it's union, it makes things go up, prices go up. But my experience has been, the prices go up whether you're a union or not. And if you are a union, you get better benefits and a better wage.
This is Karen calling from Chicago. I'm a college professor at a school with a faculty union. Unfortunately, our union, like so many unions, is weak. In the recent past, we had a president who routinely violated our contract. In the case like this, where there's a flagrant disregard of the norms, a union has to be strong enough to fight every violation. If it is not, and we were not, especially because our jobs kept us overly busy and we did not have the time, energy, or money to put to all those fights, it can get run over.
If you want to weigh in, it's not too late. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Again, that number, 8778-MY-TAKE. Later today, we'll be compiling a bunch of your stories. We'll have voices from around the country and your stories of union battles at work and how they've changed your job. They'll all appear in our daily podcast. You can check it out and see if your story made the cut. Subscribe to our podcast by visiting iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts.